Hey, deserving listeners, it's just me today. I want to talk about Virginia Satir. Virginia Satir, or as those around her knew her as Ginny. Ginny Satir. I'll never forget the first time I saw one of Satir's videos. It was when I was in grad school in 1995. And at first, it's just unforgettable seeing her videos. At first, I remember just being completely shocked. Oh, by the way, if you don't know who Satir is, she is one of the most famous family therapists of all time. And if you're in my field, you absolutely know about her. And if you aren't, then I'm guessing you don't. But I think she's a fascinating character, probably the most fascinating therapist to have lived during her time. And even if you're not a therapist, I'm guessing this will be interesting on some level. But anyway, so in graduate school to become a therapist, I remember watching one of Satir's videos. And at first, I remember just being shocked by it. The way she is as a therapist is very different than anything I'd ever seen before. She touches people. She moves them around. She gets in their face in this super nice, nurturing way. She's not yelling at people, but she's just like in this very intense way, just getting right up in people's business and just talking at them and getting them to say things that they would never say normally. And so at first I was just shocked. I was like, what am I looking at? This is like crazy town. And then over time, watching, you know, that first video, I slowly completely fell in love with her. She has an amazing approach, and she's truly inspirational as a family therapist. I still show her videos as a professor of family therapy because of a lot of reasons. One, every family therapist needs to know about Virginia Satir and her approach. But more importantly, I think it just shows that therapy can be a lot of different things. You know, we tend to think of therapy as just being this very controlled atmosphere where you sit in an office one-on-one, you're in kind of, you know, the client is on a cushiony chair or couch and the therapist is in some kind of mid-50s style chair of some kind. You know, in the movies, they always have the exact same chair that therapists sit in. And I can't remember the name of it, but they're often knockoffs of a famous 50s design. I actually bought one of those chairs once at a vintage shop in Fremont, Seattle. And when I brought it home, at first in the store, I just thought it was amazing. And then over time, I realized that the chair actually wasn't that comfortable and I stopped using it. Plus, it was just mammoth and heavy and squeaked a lot. But anyway, you know, that's normally what you see, right? And that's actually a lot of times what therapy is. But what Satir shows us, she showed us all the way back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, that therapy can be powerful. And often it's more powerful when you do other things besides sit in a chair and talk. She showed us that as a therapist, you can be spontaneous in the moment. You can react very spontaneously. She showed us that therapy can be transformational. She showed us that she can connect very quickly. I mean, her sessions wouldn't really have a ramp-up phase. Within 2 minutes, she was going at material that most therapists would wait, you know, 10 dozens of sessions to get to, because she just had this way of just going right for the gusto, you know. Now, I do have some complaints about her approach that I'll get into much later, but I'm not going to say that it's not without its critique, but I will say that overall I find her videos to be inspirational and a good model to follow in some ways. And it's true for many other therapists, particularly family therapists. Now, some people in my field will say no therapist should ever act like Virginia Satir because of the things she did, and I'll get into more of that later. You can actually watch her videos on YouTube. She has several, I think Psychotherapy Net, Psychotherapy Videos Net or whatever that organization is, they have posted some clips of her videos. I have access to, you know, dozens of full-length videos that YouTube doesn't have. But you can actually just go on YouTube, just type in Virginia Satir. Her last name is S-A-T-I-R, S-A-T-I-R, Satir. And you can watch her operate. You can also watch some of her lectures. And you really have to watch her to know her. You really have to see her in action. There's no way to describe. There's really no way to describe therapy in general, but there's no way to describe particularly her unless you see it. And so today, that's what I want to do. I'm going to do a deep dive on Virginia Satir and her therapy model. I'm going to do my typical kind of progression here. I'm going to do a deep dive on the history, on her life. She lived a very interesting life and, you know, had a very important role in the development of our field. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the model as I go through the history because I think it's important. And then I'm going to pause it and then I'm just going to have the rest of it be for patrons. So if you're listening to this on the non-patron feed, on the regular feed, then this will end after the history. But I'm guessing, according to my notes, I probably have a good hour to 2 hours of history anyway. So anyway, history, if it's for everyone, model is for patrons. Okay, so let's go into the history here. Well, first, let's introduce the podcast. How about that? This is the podcast called Psychology in Seattle. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor. I'm a marriage and family therapist in Seattle, and I'm also a professor in a marriage and family therapy program. So the history of Virginia Satir, I suppose we could start when she was born in 1916. So if she were alive today, she would be 102 this year. She was born in Neillsville, Wisconsin. Not sure where Neillsville is. I think it's a small town. She was the eldest of five children in Wisconsin, and she was born into a farming family. Her parents were Oscar and Minnie Pagenkopf, Pagenkopf, and German of German descent. There's a lot of people of German descent in the Midwest, and she is one of those people. Both of her parents came from very large families, and I've actually learned from doing my own genealogy that most families of this time were farmers and you needed a lot of labor. And so a lot of these families had lots of kids. So it's not unusual to see that. So she grew up as the oldest of five children on a farm in Wisconsin. And she said that they were working class. They struggled for money. She said, she reflected on her childhood a little bit in some of her interviews and some of her writings, and she said she was thankful she was able to learn the importance of being honest from her father. Apparently, her father instilled her with the value of honesty. I think that value of honesty carried over into her model because she was really big on congruence and being truthful with people and communication in families. Also, she apparently resented her father because he was an alcoholic. According to Satir, her father drank because he felt cheated out of a formal education and because he had to become a farmer. So he always wanted to have an education, work as a professional of some sort, and didn't like the fact that he had to settle for being a farmer. And so he apparently drank a lot to cope with that. And both of her parents valued education a lot. So both her mother and her father valued educating their children. Okay, skipping forward to 1919 when she was age three. She was a precocious child. She taught herself how to read. She famously read every book in her small school library by the age of five. She recalled that she wanted to become a detective when she was a child. Particularly, she wanted to become a detective who investigates parents, which is an interesting early profession to want to have, which, of course, in some ways, that's what she did do with the rest of her life as a family therapist, is investigate parents. Skipping forward to 1921, early 20th century, she's 5 years old, and she contracted or came down with appendicitis, very painful. But she didn't go to the hospital because her mother was a Christian Scientist. Her family was a Christian Scientist, I think, but at least her mother was a very devout Christian Scientist. And a part of, for many of these people, their belief is that they don't go to physicians, and so the mother refused to take Virginia to a physician. And as a consequence, her appendicitis got worse and her appendix ruptured, which must have been extremely painful and scary for the family. And her father stepped in and overruled her mother and took her to the hospital. And luckily, the physicians in the hospital were able to save her life. But she was extremely ill and damaged by the event, and she had to stay in the hospital for several months. Can you imagine that? Several months in the hospital, age 5. And I also read that she called herself a sickly child. So maybe it's because of that early event. So skipping forward to 1929, the Great Depression, age 13. The family moved to Milwaukee, a big city, so that Virginia could attend a better high school. And she wrote about her experience in this high school about a geometry teacher who inspired her. So this was an important figure perhaps in her development of her later career, because her early career was a teacher herself. Again, it was the Great Depression, so she had to help her family by working. And she also tried to graduate high school early so she could start working for and earning money, so the family didn't have to depend on themselves. So skipping forward to 1932, age 16, or actually just before her 16th birthday, she graduated from high school. So she pushed herself to graduate from high school when she was 15 years old, which is impressive. Right after high school, she started college at Milwaukee State Teachers College to become a teacher. It's now the University of Wisconsin. I've been to Milwaukee. It's a nice town. Shout out to Milwaukee deserving listeners. To pay for her education, she worked for a department store while she went to Milwaukee State Teachers College, now University of Wisconsin. She also worked as a babysitter during this time, probably because she was the eldest of 5 children and was used to taking care of her younger siblings. She also worked at a community center while she was in college that was geared towards African Americans in Milwaukee. This exposed her for the very first time to the reality of racism in this country. Before this point in her small town growing up on the farm, she apparently hadn't met any African Americans. And she had this quote where she says, "I had not met any black people where I was. I didn't know them from anything," unquote. Skipping forward to age 20, 1936, she graduates from the Milwaukee State Teachers College with a bachelor's degree in education, and she apparently graduated 3rd in her class. Now, I don't know how many people were in her class, but I'm guessing it was a sizable number, and so she was a smart cookie and a hardworking student to graduate 3rd in her class. After graduating with her bachelor's at the age of 20, she worked as a teacher for 6 years. And during this time, she would visit the family homes to see if there was anything else she could do to help. She really cared about her students and would actually go to the students' families' homes. And this was part of her emerging understanding of what would later become her family therapy model. After graduating with her bachelor's, she started graduate school to get her master's at Northwestern University. All right, skipping forward to age 25. In 1941, she met Gordon Russell at a train station. He was a soldier on leave from World War II, I think. And they got married later or soon after that. So Gordon Russell, she married Gordon Russell, who was a soldier in World War II. It's very common from what I understand, for soldiers to marry people under these circumstances. You know, you're leaving for war and you just feel like you need to connect with someone, and I think a lot of marriages happened with these brief encounters with soldiers at the time, or at least that's, you know, I've heard stories of such. Anyway, while he was in, you know, fighting in World War II, I don't know what he did in World War II, but while he was out there, she was pregnant from him, and she had an ectopic pregnancy that had a lot of complications, and she lost the fetus, and she needed to have a hysterectomy, apparently. So she had a hysterectomy at the age of, you know, in her late or mid-20s, before she had any other kids. Skipping forward to 1943, again, still during World War II, age 27, she completed the master's program courses after 7 years of being in the graduate school. And remember, she's working this whole time, so she's probably taking classes when she could. But she didn't get her master's until 5 years later because she needed to complete her thesis. Any of you graduate students out there who have worked on a thesis or a dissertation know how that feels, to finish all your courses and then to have a lot of time after that to get your full degree. You know, all but dissertation people, ABD people. Apparently, she, during her master's degree, she got D's in graduate school. So remember, she's always been a great student. She was a precocious child, and she graduated with her bachelor's degree third in her class. But here she goes to the master's, her master's program, and suddenly she's getting all these bad grades. And later, she would speculate that she was being discriminated against because she was a married woman who was in college, and the professors were, I'm guessing, all men, if not the majority men, if not all men. And she speculated that she was being discriminated against and therefore being graded harshly. I don't doubt this at all. I mean, 1943, I mean, you know, the gender politics are bad now. Imagine how bad they were back then. And so anyway, 1945, World War II ends, and her husband lived through it and returned home. 1948, at the age of 32, she completed her thesis and got her master's degree from Northwestern University in Chicago, and she started her private practice. But at first, she just worked with individuals because, of course, that was the standard and to some extent still is. So at the age of 32, she got her master's and she started working as a counselor. Back then, they called them social workers, I believe, because if you weren't a psychologist or psychiatrist, you were a social worker. They didn't have the counseling or therapy professions as they do now. 1949, at the age of 33, she got divorced after being married for 8 years. According to her, they apparently spent too much time away from each other during the war, and when he returned from the war, they really struggled and held on for another 4 years and then finally got divorced. 1951, age 35, she married her second husband, Norman Satir. And that's where we get her name from, because originally she was Virginia Pagenkopf. Then she was Virginia Rogers. That would have been interesting if her name was Rogers, another Rogers. And then she became Virginia Satir at the age of 35. She soon adopted two girls, age 10 and 11. These were girls she was working with at the Chicago Home for Girls. She was a therapist there. And these two girls, or one of the girls, was at the Home for Girls. But they were biological sisters, and they came from an abusive home. And she said that the children actually asked her to adopt them, which I can see. Because if you see videos of Virginia Satir, if I was a 10-year-old kid and I was in an abusive home and I met Virginia Satir, I would want Virginia to be my mom too. And this is actually an interesting thing because it's a common family therapist countertransference that people have, particularly early career, where just as Virginia was at this time, where therapists will really connect with a particular family or a particular kid or a particular, you know, group of siblings and have this super compulsion to adopt the children. And it's this frequent conversation I have with supervisees around, you can't save the world. You're going to have that feeling all the time. And if you adopted all the kids you have that feeling for, you'll have 500 children by the end of your career. So you just have to do what you can as a therapist, which is a lot, but it's not necessarily going to fix the problem, because they're suffering from a lot of things that are really just out of your control and just out of the jurisdiction of family therapy. And of course you care, and of course you want to save them, but your professional and your own just your life limitations just kind of prevent you from being able to do that. So it's interesting that Virginia Satir, I'm guessing, had the same countertransference and actually went for it and actually adopted the kids. Now, of course, she had a hysterectomy and therefore couldn't have kids. So adoption, if she wanted kids, was probably, you know, one of the only ways she could get kids. And so, you know, I guess it all made sense from that angle. So she also had an interview. There's an interview with her where she talks about this. And so I'll read her words here. "When my children first came, they regarded food as the chief vehicle of love. In those days, $500 a month for groceries was a whole lot. Even though there was all this food in the house, I would find food cached in many places." They would hide food in many places. "I just kept buying the food. It took about 3 months before they figured out that the food was not going to disappear. It was sort of hard to live through, but I finally got all that straightened out. That is one of the things that brought me to work with families. You see, I started my work with families whose members no one else wanted to work with. I knew that being able to change and grow had to do with how people felt about themselves. Of course, back then, I had not developed the word self-esteem. That was a fancy word I learned later," unquote. Okay. So kind of by the way that, you know, if you followed that quote, she has a kind of almost free associative way of talking, which I find to be a little difficult when I watch her filmed lectures. She tends to speak off the cuff, and I'm hanging on every word, but sometimes I get a little lost, like, wait, how did we get here? And you could kind of see that in this. I mean, a little bit, not a lot, but anyway. 1951, age 35, she reportedly met with her first family client. So this is after 3 years of practice. I read somewhere that she didn't work with families right away as a therapist. It took a couple years, 2 or 3 years into her practice, where she started actually working with families. This is very revolutionary. 1951, just like so long ago. She was an extreme early adopter of this notion of family therapy. She probably knew about others who had done this. There were a few vocal people who were writing about this and promoting it, but not many, and not a loud voice either. You know, it was a quiet voice among people we all know now today, but people didn't necessarily know of them back then. So she very quickly saw the power of that, again, because she came from a family. She was the oldest child of five. She, you know, saw her own family. She was probably parentified a little bit because her dad drank. She was a teacher and worked with kids and then would work with and go to the homes of the families. And so, you know, it was all kind of building up to this moment where she saw her first family. And I'm so curious to know what that first session was like with Virginia Satir, because she had such a weird approach later, or such a distinctive, different approach that we see in her later videos. And I just wonder if she was like that when she started out. I don't know. So after working with families now, so at this point, she, you know, before this moment, she wasn't a family therapist. She was just a regular, quote unquote, social worker. And then she sees her first family and boom, she just immediately sees the usefulness of it. And she very quickly takes to it and starts to really focus on it. 1953, age 37, she started working at the Illinois Psychiatric Institute, and she as a therapist. But she also worked as a teacher, because remember, she was trained as a teacher, and she really took to training. And one of her students, so she would teach family therapy techniques at this institute, as well as being a therapist. And one of her teachers was actually Ivan Nagy. I did an episode on Nagy recently, and it's interesting that Nagy actually came to this institute, or was around and actually took at least one class from Virginia Satir. Which again, I just find it so interesting. I just love to be a fly in the wall as Nagy walks into Satir's class and gets taught. It's just amazing to think about. He would have been 4 years younger than her. He would have been like 33-ish, and she was 37. So at this point, she's teaching, she's developing her own ideas about family therapy, and I'm guessing she was also reading a lot of stuff from a lot of the other pioneers by this point. Because if she's teaching it, I just have to imagine that she's well aware of the other figures in family therapy. People like John Bell, Nathan Ackerman, Christian Middlefort, Theodore Lids, Lyman Wynn, Murray Bowen, Carl Whitaker, Gregory Bateson. And I think I read somewhere that she also was into Harry Stack Sullivan at this time, which I find to be great because I like him as well. Okay, so skipping forward to 1957, she's 41 years old now, and she gets divorced again after being married to Mr. Satir for 6 years. At the end of her life, she talked about this, her divorces, in an interview. She said, I have often thought, had there been someone like me around, something might have been able to be done. So that's a weird sentence. Anyway, so she's like, I've often thought, if someone was like me, marriage would have been good for me. Then she goes on to say, I also think I don't see how I could have done what I've done in the world had I been married. I've been on the verge of marriage many times, but I said no because I wanted to roam the globe. I said no to marriage because I wanted to roam the globe. So this is so interesting, because what it kind of is a window into is her personal life, is that if she was on the verge of marriage many times, that means she dated a lot of dudes or people. It's just interesting to think about Virginia Satir after her, you know, in her 40s, after being divorced twice. She's just like, I'm just going to date now. And then she's like, maybe I should marry this person. And then, you know, I want to roam the globe. I want to educate. I don't got time for this. I'm gonna go my own way, as they say. All right, 1958, age 42. Don Jackson, the famous Don Jackson, invited her to join him in California to study family therapy. Apparently, Virginia Satir was very good at networking with other professionals, because at this point, again, she's not famous, and she's basically just kind of starting out in her career, and she basically has just started doing family therapy, and she basically just started teaching it. And somehow, Don Jackson knew about her, and I'm guessing it was because Satir apparently is famously good at networking and communicating with other professionals, and so I'm guessing somehow they connected, and Don Jackson liked her and thought she would be a great asset to his work. So he invited her out, and, you know, she's divorced now, so she can go anywhere she wants. And so she moved to California to be with what would eventually be called the Mental Research Institute, or MRI. In family therapy, this institute is probably the most famous family therapy center. And so there's that. Don Jackson had recently received financial backing to study schizophrenia and the family. So if you don't know this, a lot of early family therapy studies and efforts and funding happened in the 1950s as a result of people and foundations and the government paying psychiatrists and other people like Virginia Satir to study schizophrenia and to figure out why it was happening, you know? And there were some people that started to think, well, maybe it's, you know, maybe it's a psychoanalytic thing, maybe it's a behaviorism thing, maybe it's this and that. And then other people thought, well, maybe it's the family. Maybe the family is the cause of the schizophrenia. Now, we look back on that now and we realize the family is not the cause of schizophrenia. The family can exacerbate the symptoms for sure, but we now know that it's not. But at the beginning, they wanted to see if it was, and they had some early hypotheses about it. And what it did is it gave the field of family therapy this jump start because it was funding for research and for publications and for people to really figure this stuff out and to develop family therapy models. Murray Bowen also got his start in this way, in that in some ways, in that he was in these, you know, studies for schizophrenia and the family. So Don Jackson had got some money, starts this mental research institute in Palo Alto, asks Virginia Satir to join him. And the original staff consisted of just Don Jackson, Virginia Satir, and Jules Riskin, along with a secretary. So three therapists, Don Jackson, Virginia Satir, and Jules Riskin were all that was of the Mental Research Institute in Palo Alto. It later became quite bigger. And again, the original purpose when it first got off the ground, Mental Research Institute, was to research how family relationships affected mental health in general and specifically schizophrenia. All right, well, let's take a break. When we get back, we'll continue with the history. All right, we're back from the break. If you haven't become a patron, do so now. Go to patreon.com. Become a patron of the podcast. Do it. Okay, so 1962, getting up to the British invasion, Beatles, the Stones, Moody Blues, who else? Ginny is now age 46 in the early 60s. She was practicing as a therapist, and she was also informally teaching other therapists about family therapy during her off hours, often late in the evenings, at the Mental Research Institute. And in 1962, so MRI has been around for, Mental Research Institute has been around for about 4 years, and it received a huge grant from the National Institute of Mental Health to begin the first formal family therapy training program ever offered. And they were funded for 5 years, and Satir was named the training director. So in a way, Satir was the very first family therapy teacher, which is great. So that's 1962. I'm guessing that Don Jackson, Satir, were so good at networking and so good at grant writing, maybe, and so good at coming up with ideas that the National Institute of Mental Health actually said, yeah, because there were a number of other centers that were probably vying for that funding. And I mean, I don't know the history, but that's just usually how things go. Anyway, 1964, age 48. Virginia is 48 at this point, and she published her very first book. It's a very famous book of hers called Conjoint Family Therapy, 1964. This was a revolutionary book in some ways. I mean, there had been publications about family therapy before, so it wasn't like this was brand new, but it was extremely popular. And it right there in the title, Conjoint Family Therapy, meaning that you meet conjointly. You meet with, you know, family members in the room together. And in this book, I have this book actually in front of me right now, and it's written entirely in outline form. It's a full book, and the entire book is a series of bullet points. You know, it'll be like number five, and then she has like a sentence or two sentences about this idea that she has. You know, families, blah blah blah, da da da, da. And then she has these bullet points underneath, and I can't tell you how much I love this style of writing, because this is the way I think. Like when I just published my book, coincidentally at the exact same age as Virginia Satir when she published her first book, called Multi-Role Clinical Supervision. And while I was writing it, the first number of drafts, the first, I don't know, three or four drafts that I thought were final, by the way, it took me another, I don't know, literally 50 to 100 other drafts before I was actually done. How naive I thought after the first three drafts that it would be done. But anyway, those early drafts were very Satirian in that they had a lot of bullet points and a lot of outline kind of things, because that's how I think. I think of things as idea and then support. Like right now, my notes are outline form. They, you know, I don't, when I hope, I mean, if you listen to this podcast, you know that a lot of times I'm working off my notes. Well, right now I'm on page 5 of 13 pages of notes, and it's all bullet points. And because I love bullet points, because you can, you know, you can indent the bullet points based on what it is a subject under, right? So, you know, so you can have all these like embedded levels of ideas within something. So her entire book is that. And I just have, and whenever I would show my early drafts of my book to people, they would complain that it looked too much like an outline. And I just have to say now, you know, well, Virginia Satir did it first, so I should. it was good feedback that I should actually just write out the book, and everyone loved it much better after I did that. Anyway, so Conjoint Family Therapy, you know, a very popular book. I would say every family therapist has a copy of it, and it emphasized family therapy. It emphasized the importance of self-worth. Later, she would call that self-esteem. And it was also based on her courses that she developed at the Mental Research Institute. So as she's teaching, she's like, maybe I should just write a book about this. And it kind of reads like that. It reads like a curriculum. It reads like a PowerPoint that a teacher would follow as they teach a class. So, she would publish many other books after this, and all of them were well received. She was asked to speak and teach all over the country at this point. So she kind of rocketed to fame in the 60s. And she, you know, this book came out, and, you know, suddenly she starts getting all this notoriety, and people are asking her to come and teach. The thing I always point out when I'm talking about this history is like right now you could be anywhere in the world right now listening to this podcast, right? Well, back in the day, if I lived back then and I wanted to teach people something or talk about something, I would actually have to travel to places and do trainings and have lectures in lecture halls and stuff. Because, you know, this is the 60s. They're not necessarily filming things and sending those films around, right? So Virginia, that's what she did. I'm positive today she would just have a podcast. But back then, you know, they didn't have such things. And so she traveled all over the country and in other countries talking about family therapy and her ideas of family therapy. And she became, by many people's accounts, the best spokesperson for family therapy that has ever lived. She's sort of like our Carl Sagan in some ways. She was the most clear and the most accessible of all the founders of family therapy. And I mean, Mnuchin probably is up there too, but Satir just has a, especially, I guess Mnuchin and Satir, that's why I call Mnuchin and Satir like the real parents for me in terms of family therapy. Anyway, her reputation grew from this point forward through the 70s, 80s, 90s. She just got bigger and bigger. And the things that she added to family therapy during this time were things having to do with emotions and self-esteem and connection and love and how therapists need to be nurturing. That was really new. I also read somewhere that during this time, 60s, 70s, 80s, that there were posters made of things that she said, and maybe with her face on it, I don't know. And agencies and therapy offices would actually buy these posters and put them up on the wall of the agency. And so and that just makes me laugh because there's nothing like that today. You know, no one has a poster of Mnuchin saying something, right? It's sort of what it tells me is that at this time, it was kind of like the way people look at rock stars, right? It's not uncommon for someone to buy a poster of a rock star or an actor that they like or a movie that they like, right? Well, I think there was so much hero worship during this time that it's like, ooh, I want a poster of Virginia Satir and put it up on my wall. I mean, I don't know their attitude, but that's just kind of what it seems like to me. All right, skipping forward to 1970, she is 54 years old now. And she has left the Mental Research Institute after having been there for about 8 years. Also, Don Jackson had died a year or two earlier, the main founder of MRI. And so that might have been a factor. Naj and Haley Jay Haley were also at the Mental Research Institute, and they had left around this time as well to go to Philadelphia to start their clinic. You want to listen to my episode on Naj if you want to know more about that. Virginia Satir at this time became the director of training at the Aselin Institute. I don't know how to pronounce this word, Aselin Institute. I think it's Aselin Institute. It's in Big Sur, California, and it was sort of a famous hippie, sort of experimental therapy center of the world, and it survived until recently, actually. It was, I think it was only recently shut down. I don't know why. Maybe they just decided not to do it anymore. But anyway, I think she had been dabbling there throughout the 60s, but then around 1970, she became the director of training there and was a full-time employee there. And it was a popular place for the human potential movement, which began in the 1950s and became popular in the late 60s, early 70s. For you young people, you probably have never heard of this human potential movement, but I'm a little too young for it myself. I'm 47. Older people probably definitely, particularly people in California, remember the human potential movement. It's where a lot of humanistic therapy ideas kind of were associated with. There were things like encounter groups, if you've heard of that were happening at the Aselin Institute in Big Sur, California, where Fritz Perls was there. And so this is where she went. So she went from this kind of buttoned up research institute in Palo Alto, Mental Research Institute, and then she goes to this super experimental kind of out there place where people are thinking about the mind-body connection and spirituality and doing things like ialogues, not dialogues, but ialogues in which you express yourself to each other just with your eyes. So you dialogue with your eyes only. I mean, you know, a lot of this stuff we would associate with New Age or with, I don't know, just that kind of stuff. But back then it was brand new. You would have these encounter groups or what they called T groups. And people would sit in a circle and they would just be real, right? They you know, people like Fritz Perls and other therapists around this time, humanistic people, including Virginia Satir, would encourage these people to just fully express themselves. If you can think of hippie culture, you know, that's what we're talking about. People might scream if they wanted to. Therapists would encourage people to connect with each other and to connect with themselves. This is where a lot of the humanistic ideas came from, and the early Gestalt, sort of Fritz Perls version of Gestalt ideas came from. So Virginia Satir continued to do family therapy here, and she would also teach it. And it was here where she learned, I think, a lot of her experiential therapy ideas. Many others taught at the Aselin Institute. Fritz Perls, as I said, was a major figure there. Carl Rogers, Rollo May, Gregory Bateson, Joseph Campbell, Spalding Gray apparently taught there. Maslow, Artie Lang, B.F. Skinner. So a lot of the big names did stints there where Satir was in charge of teaching. During this time in the 70s, she also founded what was called Beautiful People, which was a network of some kind. It later became the International Human Learning Resources Network, but originally it was called Beautiful People, and it provided resources and support to mental health workers, and it also taught people how to connect with one another. So it was. I'm guessing that she wanted her own brand to market or have control over in this human potential movement, and so she had this Beautiful People organization. 1972, she publishes perhaps her second most famous book called People Making. I'm not going to mention all the other books. Those are the only two books I'm going to mention. So mid-1970s, she's in her 50s at this point. Her work was extensively studied by the founders of NLP, or Neuro-Linguistic Programming, Richard Bandler and John Grinder. They used Satir's model as one of the three fundamental models in NLP. And they also collaborated with Satir on a book. And I'm not sure how I feel about this. I have friends who actually work in NLP and actually will tell me that that Bandler and Grinder have a controversial past, I guess. But so anyway, just a little notable bit of history there. 1977, I am now 6 years old, and she is 61 years old. She created the Avanta Network, which was later renamed the Virginia Satir Global Network. This was similar to the Beautiful People Network. It provided resources and support for mental health workers, and it also taught people how to connect with one another. So it was her humanistic kind of organization. She became a part of a lot of different organizations, like on the International Family Therapy Association. She was on the steering committee. She was a member of the advisory board for the National Council for Self-Esteem, and there were a lot of other kind of things she was involved in the 70s. She was really huge during this time, and many of her famous videos were made during the 70s and early 80s. So she was perhaps at the height of her fame at this time. Skipping forward to 1988, I am a junior in high school, and she is 72 years old, and she starts to experience stomach pains. 72. She was hospitalized and diagnosed with pancreatic cancer that had spread to her liver, and the physicians said they did not think that they could actually get rid of the cancer. They could treat her with chemotherapy and other kinds of things, but they wouldn't be able to get rid of it completely. And so she decided to not engage in treatment, and so, figuring that there wasn't any point in doing anything about it. And she figured she was going to die soon, and she wrote these words during this time. Quote, To all my friends, colleagues, and family, I send you my love. Please support me in my passage to a new life. I have no other way to thank you than this. You have all played a significant part in my development of loving. As a result, my life has been rich and full, so I leave feeling very grateful, unquote. She died on September 10th, 1988. According to her wishes, she was cremated, and her remains were taken to Mount Crested Butte in Colorado. Skipping forward to 1995, I'm 24 years old, and I enter graduate school, and I learn about her, and I saw her videos as I talked about it, and at first was shocked, but then really loved it. 2 years later, I graduated with my master's, age 26, and I started teaching at Antioch University, and I would teach her model, and I would show her videos. And I did so for 21 years until today, 2018, age 47. I finally got the time to do a deep dive on her after many people have asked me to do so, and here we are. All right, so what can we say about her career? She was one of a kind. I don't think anyone would disagree with that statement. She was one of a kind, and she was so nurturing. no one else is like her in this way. Carl Rogers comes close, but no one can come close to Virginia Satir and how nurturing, how mothering, how maternal she was. If you've seen videos of her and the vibe she gives off, she just gives off the vibe of a very powerful grandmother. A grandmother who is confident and is competent and knows what's what and is calm but firm. I mean, she just has that vibe about her in every context that she's in. And yeah, one of a kind. She became one of the most famous names in family therapy, if not psychotherapy as a whole. Throughout her career, she developed her own model of therapy. She wrote several influential works. She provided probably thousands of workshops and trainings on family therapy. She established professional training groups all over the world, the Middle East, Asia, Western Europe, Eastern Europe, Central America, South America, Russia, etc. She probably worked with tens of thousands of families in her practice. You know, I was thinking about it as I was going over the history of her and history of family therapy. It's possible that she single-handedly created our field. We don't usually think of her that way. You know, we think of Gregory Bateson or Ackerman or Don Jackson, for that matter, Marie Bowen. But she was so popular and so loved and so prolific and so dogged in her promotion of her model and the general model of family therapy that you just have to wonder what our profession would have been like without her. You know, it's one thing to have a model of therapy called family therapy. It's a whole other thing to have me, who was a licensed marriage and family therapist. I mean, the governments of America and around the world have been lobbied and successfully to license a particular profession called marriage and family therapy. And we're separate from psychology, and we're separate from counseling, we're separate from social work, separate from psychiatry and psychiatric nursing in the medical field. We are our own profession with our own lobbyists and our own professional organization and our own training programs. And back then, it wasn't that way. It very easily, our field could have become just, you know, subsumed in the general field. Like, you know, we don't have a profession called, cognitive therapists, right? The people who developed cognitive therapy are subsumed in all the other therapies. You know, you can't become a licensed cognitive therapist. So why do we have licensed marriage and family therapists? Well, I think part of it is because of the popularity of Virginia Satir and those who flocked to her and were inspired by her and who felt empowered by her to establish our field. Now, you know, I don't have a finger on the pulse of history of family therapy, but you just have to wonder, you know. She influenced our field in a big way. I think she was definitely the beacon of compassion and humanism and connection and love and being real. No other family therapist figure was really like that at the time. I mean, I love humanistic psychology and psychotherapy. I use it all the time. And to see Satir influence family therapy in this way is just really great. Throughout her career, she won several awards and honors, including the gold medal of outstanding and consistent service to mankind by the University of Chicago. She was awarded a number of honorary doctorates. In 1982, she was selected by the West German government as one of the 12 most influential leaders in the world today. I mean, huh? It's just interesting. 1982, one of the 12 most influential leaders in the world by the West German government. 1987, she was named honorary member of the Czechoslovakian Medical Society. And around this time in the 80s, in two national surveys among mental health professionals, she was voted the most influential therapist of all time. So in the United States, again, there was a time. So she above Freud, above Jung, above Adler, above Kohut, above Bowen, above above every other therapist in at two particular years, she was voted the most influential therapist who had ever lived. That's amazing. That is just amazing. And I'm here to tell you that in some family therapy books, she is not discussed at length. She is kind of glanced over. And I think that that has to do, obviously, with sexism. And I think it also has to do with her, the way that she is was so different that I think it scares people, which I'll get into when I talk about her model. So again, as I said, this episode is just for patrons of the podcast. So if you're listening to this and you're not a patron yet of this podcast, then this episode is going to end soon before the rest of this episode carries on. If you want to hear the full episode, you have to become a patron of the podcast by going to patreon.com. Just go there, create an account, and become a patron of our podcast, and you can become a patron of several other things as well. When you become a patron, you get access to hundreds of patron-exclusive episodes in which we do deep dives like this into various different topics. And when you become a patron, you don't have to listen to the vast majority of commercials, which some of you do not like. And also, remember that a portion of your pledge goes towards various charities that we support, including Pet Finder Foundation, which we just made a $2,000 donation to from patron support. So do that now.